the strait is closed. At the start of this year, we went down to zero, and now we're arguing about whether it's 2 or 4.
In some ways, who cares what's going on through the Strait of Hormuz? The price tells you what's going on. I want to be clear, I have no edge in telling you what is going to happen. Anyone who tells you otherwise is full of shit. What you might have edge in is understanding the second and third order consequences of the circumstances and the pricing that exists in the market. That's really where the opportunity is.
Bob Elliott is the co-founder and CEO of Unlimited, where he brings hedge fund-style macro and alternative strategies to investors through low-cost ETFs.
While Arhan Menon is the founder of Prometheus Research, a systematic macro research firm that turns global macro data and market signals into actionable portfolios for both individuals and institutions.
How does an oil shock go from an oil shock to perhaps like a big equity market drawdown? Once you start getting that earnings re-rating, that's when you start getting the consistent downward pressure on equity.
Stocks are basically pricing in no chance that this will have any effect on the macroeconomy ahead. Well, I'll take the over of no chance.
The trouble is that a standard 60-40 portfolio most folks hold is effectively an all-in bet in peace and disinflation.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today, I'm very honored. I have had two absolute titans from the macro space with me on Less Noise, More Signal, Arhan and Bob Elliott. Arhan from Prometheus Research. So it's great to have you guys with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be on. I'm excited.
Yes, great. Yeah, thanks for you, Arhan, for making this work. I know you told me you guys have been knowing each other for quite some while personally, so it's cool that we can get this joint episode working. I mean, maybe just quickly to start off, given that some of the people that might be listening to my show don't know who you guys are in detail, so if you could quickly elaborate, each of you, that would be great. Maybe start with you,
Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey there, folks. I'm Bob Elliott. I've been in the hedge fund business for a couple of decades, where I was at Bridgewater Associates, the world's largest hedge fund, creating proprietary strategies. And since I left, I started a business called Unlimited, which brings manager diversified, low cost hedge fund strategy returns to every investor in the ETF wrapper, through a series of, right now, 4 ETFs listed in the United States. And I still do a lot of macro writing through my non-consensus Substack and various social media posts on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, great. What about you, Arhan?
Yeah, so my name is Arhan. I'm the founder of Prometheus Research. Prometheus is a systematic macro research provider. So what we do is we spend a lot of time understanding macro data, macro market action, turning that into quantified signals and make that into actionable portfolios. We do that both for individuals, so, you know, individuals investing their own money, and we also do that for institutions, so pension funds and hedge funds and things like that. And, you know, we basically cover the entire global asset universe. And our specialty is basically something that overlaps with what, you know, Bob does, which is systematizing how you're thinking through the macro picture and creating investment strategies to navigate different macro environments.
Yeah, that's great. So as I said, I have two absolute titans with us today. And so I really want to start with this mapping out the macro environment, you know, and I guess the most pressing question to start with, or that everybody's has on its mind nowadays is really, is the Strait of Hormuz, is it actually effectively closed or not, you know? And I think you probably saw it as well, this recent Citrini piece where they sent actually somebody down there to check things out, and he kind of challenged the narrative of it being effectively shut. And so I'd be interested in your guys' view. Is that the case? Is this stuff still moving through from what you can gather, or is traffic even picking up, or what is your guys' comment? Maybe we start with you, Bob.
Yeah, well, I think these are the sorts of things that always happen in gradation. So I mean, a lot of times people will use rhetoric that is kind of comes across as absolutist when it is true that there's more nuance in the sense of like, look, we're starting at 20 million barrels a day flow. We are doing something today when it comes to oil that is meaningfully less than 20 million barrels a day. Is that, you know, the two from Iran and then maybe, you know, one or two that's sneaking around that we can't quite track and don't really know that's, you know, maybe sneaking through. Like, sure, that's possible. But it's the sort of thing where you really shouldn't get hung up on like the marginal, like did six ships get through or three ships get through? Or, you know, is there somebody who is hiding getting through? The big picture story is that we have on the order of magnitude of 10 million barrels that has been taken off the market. And, you know, that's generated a pretty significant shock in oil prices. I mean, traded oil. So if you just don't, not even the first nearby, which is in some cases, you know, months ahead, is traded oil. Like in Brent oil traded in the North Sea is at $140 a barrel. That is an incredibly high cost given we started the year at 60. And so in some ways, who cares what's going on through the Strait of Hormuz? The price tells you what's going on, which is there's not enough oil getting out there, and therefore we're having a significant supply shock in the spot market.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I don't know if you have anything to add on from your side, from what you've been observing.
I think my biggest concern right now is that we're going to have too much violent agreement on this podcast. So that's my main concern out the gate. But I think, you know, just to kind of add to what Bob's saying is that, you know, I don't think, like, unless you're super, super in the weeds of, you know, every single tanker ship that's passing through the strait, whether, you know, you're documenting that correctly or not, by every measurable metric, the strait is closed, right? Like, we had about 70-ish ships passing through the strait every single day, you know, at the start of this year. We went down to zero, and now we're arguing about whether it's two or four, you know, like, that by any stretch of the imagination is basically a strait which is closed. You know, you look across the timely measures of satellite data and things like that, you know, global inventory reads are basically consistent with that 10 million barrels a day down, which is basically a 10%-ish drop in global inventories. And that's resulting in huge pressure. You know, you look at geographically, you look at the spreads between oil. So, you know, you look at Brent WTI, you look at, you know, DLF, you look at all these different measures of oil, and basically what you see is that there's very, very intense pressure on delivery. And so, you know, I think that maybe if you're trying to do some turning point type analysis of, oh, the strait is actually going to, you know, open from here, you could do that. But I think the realistic thing is that, you know, you have to go from four ships passing through the strait a day back to 70 to be fully reopened. And that's just an order of magnitude difference and like a completely different regime. So by all, you know, reasonable big picture standards, I think the strait is very much closed.
How do you think about this going forward? I mean, yes, is it sort of that it is getting linearly worse or even exponentially worse? I mean, the longer this drags on, and I know it's not only about the strait being sort of shut, or it's also about before that we heard about these attacks on all these oil facilities throughout all of the Middle East, you know, and they are being attacked, and that is probably capacity that is falling off as well. And so how do you think about this now going forward? I don't know, maybe Bob, you want to chip in? Or
yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those cases where what's going on is it's not a macroeconomic dynamic, and I think that's a very important important framing, because it helps you understand whether you have edge. I want to be clear. I have no edge in telling you what is going to happen with the Strait of Hormuz. No, literally not. And I can tell you if only four ships are passing through, you know, oil is going to be $150.
in the spot market, like that relationship, I can tell you. But in terms of what's likely to transpire, those are matters of political decisions. And those political decisions, like in some way, shape, or form, are being influenced by macroeconomic considerations, but not really in an immediate time frame. And so, and my guess is that anyone who tells you otherwise is full of shit, because they probably have no edge in figuring out what's going on. And so what's probably more important in this environment is to start to think about, okay, if you don't have edge in predicting what's likely to transpire, then how can you trade markets by both recognizing that you have low confidence, meaning like you don't really know exactly how that's going to play out. And number two, what you might have edge in is understanding the second and third order consequences of the circumstances and the pricing that exists in the market. That's really where the opportunity
is. It's a great point, you know, because framing it like this, like having edge, I mean, probably hardly anyone does have edge when it comes to really knowing what's going on here, you know, because none of us is really there on the ground. I mean, you really have to be part of these military operations, I guess, if you really want to know what could potentially happen. So, I mean, that's a great way of framing it. I don't know, in terms of, you know, you mentioned the oil price, which is already sort of signaling this, you know, and now third order, second order effects that you mentioned. I mean, this could be a point where some people would say, well, I mean, the oil price, yeah, it might be signaling that we have some shortage going on there. But then at the same time, if you look at other prices, equity indices so far year to date, they're flat, you know, and they seem not to be that worried about these potential second order or third order effects coming. So are they just late to the party? Is the worst yet to come? Or like, yeah, when we zoom into these second order or third order effects, what could be coming and why are equity markets then not catching up? That would be one of my follow-up questions.
Bob, do you want to take
that? That one's all yours.
Okay.
Because that's the hard question.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
So I think, you know, when you kind of think through the reason the S&P 500 isn't down. So first off, like, we're not going to have an exact reason, right? Like, we don't have that exact like flow of like why it isn't down. You know, you could have had like a couple days of really big pension rebalancing clustered together and you get your 3% up day. So that happens. But I think when you really kind of zoom out and think through, I think it's a matter of sequencing, right? Like, how does an oil shock go from an oil shock to perhaps like a big equity market drawdown, right? And typically how it goes is like you have the first order effect is as the oil shock happens, you kind of have these correlation based effects, right? So oil is up tremendously. That is a weight on stocks and bonds through the discount rate effect almost immediately, right? So that type of thing is something that is kind of like a relative value trade and also a very immediate repricing that's done by fast money players. And so that occurs within, you know, minutes to a day, you know, that type of thing. And that's what's really caused all the equity whipsaw. So if you've seen, equities have basically been negatively correlated to most of the oil moves, and so have treasuries, right? So the first order effect is that cross asset pricing effect, which is a lot of what you've seen. From there, you start to see the flow through of the of the oil shock into an inflation shock. So, you know, an oil price spike, if it happens over one day, it doesn't flow to consumers on that very same day. It slowly kind of makes its way into the economy and people begin to see it at the pump. Maybe they begin to see it in goods related to energy, things related to motor vehicles or places where oil is a very important input. It begins to flow into CPI. So that's the second, right? After you have that, that's when you begin to have kind of the demand response. So that's when consumers have to start making a choice of, oh my God, like gas prices are up X percent, you know, do I have to shift my, you know, my consumption in some way, or, you know, move some of my consumption from this basket to this basket. That's the third. And then finally, after that, you know, if you have a meaningful shift in demand in response to this inflation shock, that's when you start seeing the growth go down. And the growth growing down is what leads to the earnings re-rating, right? So you got to think through the way earnings expectations are kind of baked in by most analysts is on a bottom-up basis, right? What they're seeing on a bottom-up basis. And so they aren't always looking at these top-down macro drivers. And so once you start getting that earnings re-rating, that's when you start getting the consistent downward pressure on equities. And so when you think through that kind of, that's a long sequence, right? Like that's not something that happens in like a month. And so in some ways, you know, opportunistically, you know, for people like myself or Bob that are thinking through the opportunities and the linkages, I think that it's attractive to think through that equities may be mispriced. But in terms of looking at it and saying, why aren't equities down? I think that in some ways, it's a little bit natural that, hey, like we haven't had any bad data yet. There's no bad data. So you can't really expect the initial downside momentum in equities to really begin like that.
Particularly in a context where there's uncertainty about how quickly it'll resolve. Because of course, the equity market is pricing in a range of different probabilistic scenarios, meaning like there was some probability that that the administration was going to follow through on its rhetoric last week, and there's some probability that they weren't, and there's some probability that we'd get a deal in Islamabad this weekend, and there's some probability that we haven't. And there's some probability that it just gets resolved, you know, instead of at the meeting in Islamabad, it gets resolved, you know, quickly thereafter. And so I think part of that, part of what you're seeing is all of these folks weighing all these different probabilities in the short term and not, and in some ways, like that path that you just described, like, I mean, it takes forever. Like with people who have an attention span of like 12 minutes, like talking about like a multi-stage process that will take 6, 9, or 12 months to play out, it's just like not on people's minds. Like they just don't think about the world that way, even though that is absolutely right. That's a reality. That's how this sort of thing will play out. I think part of, again, if you come back to like, what can you trade? And even if you don't necessarily know exactly, for instance, whether there'll be a deal done immediately or not, start to think about the probability. So if you look at what's priced into the markets right now, let's say what's priced in the equity market, equities are actually up relative to bonds, meaning, you know, we were just talking about the discount rate effect, which is the first effect is that you have a discount rate, which is basically interest rates go up and that should bring down all asset prices. Well, actually, stocks are doing even better than that, which that essentially implies, think about stocks are just earnings over discount rates to oversimplify how stocks work. That actually means that people think that earnings are going to be stronger ahead than they did before the war started. Now, that's an unusual conclusion, a curious conclusion, let's say, to a 50%+ rise in oil prices, but a conclusion or a market pricing that exists nonetheless. And when you look at that, you basically say, whether I'm looking at stocks or bonds or the dollar, or most asset markets, like basically nothing's changed when we have this possibility. You know, it's possible this is transitory and it just, you know, gets resolved instantaneously. But certainly the probability that it doesn't and it has all these second and third order consequences is non-zero. And so when you think about the sort of the skew that exists in the market, the skew of the possibilities, the market stocks in particular, and particularly stocks relative to bonds, are basically pricing in no chance that this will have any effect on the macro economy ahead. Well, I'll take the over of no chance, right? That's how you start to build, even though I don't necessarily know whether it'll be resolved, you can probabilistically think about what's the possibility. It's certainly non-zero that this thing drags on for 6, 9, 12 months, the path that, you know, was just described plays out. And so that's where you have to sort of think in an environment where you don't actually have edge in predicting the policy outcome.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, yeah, because in the end, that's exactly my question. You know, I see so many people also maybe just rookies and people who haven't been in markets and are now pros like you guys, you know, trying to gain some edge, as you just described, by looking at price of equity markets, by looking at maybe also oil volatility and kind of figuring out, okay, you know, I see implied volatility is not up as much. And that's why I think there's some discrepancy when you compare it to spot prices and stuff like this. But then, as you on greatly said, I mean, it's this causal chain of things happening, you know, with the second and third and fourth order effect, and they can be lagging. And obviously, it's so hard to think about, when the next step will be on. And so that's kind of like what I'm trying to figure out, how to properly think about this, you know. And it's probably also that, that the thing that you mentioned, Bob, with the earnings, I mean, some companies will probably profit off of higher oil prices, you know, obviously. And that might be where some opportunities are, but not everyone obviously will equally profit. So yeah, maybe you guys have some thoughts on this as well.
I mean, I think that, you know, the case Bob has outlined, it makes sense for anybody who's trying to add value to a portfolio. Like, the way you're probably going to be able to add value to a portfolio, unless you're extremely reactive, right? So we do some of the stuff where we're trading, you know, various energy contracts and all that type of stuff. But you have to be immensely reactive to everything that's happening in the market. And you have to understand that that space is extremely saturated. If you're trying to look at like CallSkew versus SPAR and things like that, like, you are going to get eaten up because there are people that are sending people to the strait in order to actually try and figure out what's going on the ground. And they have best in class tech. They have absolutely no latency in the execution. Like, you're just not going to be able to do that. Maybe one of you out of the thousands of listeners, we can actually do that. But the thing is that trading the first order effect, which is the cross asset pricing, is really hard, right? Like that. There's edge there, but it's very hard for most people to get. It's the things that are going to be valuable to most portfolios is thinking through what we know is if these effects don't reverse. And I think that this is like a crucial thing. And I'm not sure whether Bob agrees on this or not. But I think that even if we get a de-escalation from here, what you need for us not to go through that sequence of events is you need to have a for us not to go through that sequence of events, we need to have a reversal of everything that's happened in oil prices. We don't need, like, if we stagnate from here, we're still going to have an inflationary pressure that's going to work its way through the supply chain, and we're still going to have to deal with all of those effects that I've outlined. So when you think through that and say, okay, if we don't have a reversal, we're going to have all of these effects. What are the downstream implications for my portfolio? And adjusting your allocation based on those potential downstream effects, I think that's where the most value is. And I think that, you know, one thing that's important to recognize is that, like, you're essentially betting on the linkages, right? You're betting on the linkages. And so you're getting compensated for taking on the risk that those linkages don't actually work in the way that I've outlined them. But when you make the cross-asset price bet immediately, you know the linkages because of the correlations are so tight. But that just means that there's a lower risk that those relationships don't work. And that's why people with a lot of fast money bet on those things more often. So I think that you have to accept that maybe the linkages don't work the exact way that we're describing. But that's the reason you might get compensated for, you know, making these bets in the future.
When you think about cross-assets, like, go look at, you know, August delivery Brent is at $90.
Uh-huh.
And like, functionally the price at the gas pump, you know, there's delays from there, let's say, operational delays from there that would mean basically that, you know, consumers would be seeing the equivalent of $90 oil prices at the at the pump until September, October, kind of in that range. Okay, if we have $90 oil, or what? I mean, that's basically $4 gasoline, give or take, through the end of October. Okay, will there be economic pain? Right, like that's the question you can answer. Right, that's actually a package you could trade. You could basically say stocks are implying a certain thing here, oil's implying a certain thing here. If those two realities, you know, if you could lock in the oil price. I mean, if you're trading in small scale, you probably can't, but, like, you know, at any reasonable size, you can start to lock in the oil price or use proxies or things like that in order to basically sell that oil, you know, and lock in that price. And you can make a bet on whether essentially the market is appropriately considering $90 oil. I think part of the story here, and this is why, you know, the macro nerds love these sort of environments, is like the equity analyst who's waiting for the earnings report from the consumer products company or the consumer, you know, discretionary company has no idea that August oil delivery is at $90 in Brent. Like, literally no idea, right? If you'd ask them, like, what do you think August oil is? And they'd say, I'm sorry, what is August oil? Yeah. You know, like, they have no idea, right? And that's the advantage in macro, is you can start to think about this whole series of interlocking conditions and how they're relatively priced across markets, and that's where the best opportunities lie.
Interesting. Yeah, you mentioned inflation, Ahan. You know, obviously, I'd be curious to double click on this as well. I mean, it's again maybe zooming out a little bit, but then, you know, how do you think about this? How will this filter through? I mean, we just had CPI come in month over month. Obviously, it was up already, but below expectation. And so some people might be rushing to fast conclusions again. Okay, see, we're already overestimating the impact. But you rightly pointed out, well, I mean, we haven't really gotten the data yet. You know, this needs to kind of take its time and filter through. How do you think about this? And then, because obviously, for me, an interesting question is then, if it actually filters through and we'll see that type of inflation, maybe also in core showing up and stuff like this, this will have central bank then get kind of nervous again, you know? Or how do you guys think about this going on? Is this a kind of an important question to ask, giving these second order and third order effects, the actions of central banks going forward, right?
So when it comes to the CPI, so, you know, just kind of addressing the below expectation versus above expectation kind of thing. I'm very familiar with all the, you know, the typical models that are used on the sell side. I know Bob is intimately familiar with them as well. And they're actually, you know, at a headline level, they're actually all very good, right? So like you gotta think about the fact that most of these guys are playing for like one basis point of difference in terms of their accuracy when it comes to headline CPI. So like, you know, it being, you know, the read being below expectations, really what it boils down to is that, you know, all CPI nowcasts are basically taking various measures of energy market prices, smoothing them and translating them into their impact to headline CPI. Now, depending on the contract mix that you use, right? So if you use the front month versus the mid month versus, you know, like the back months, you're going to get slightly different sensitivities. In this type of environment, there is no sell side institution that is going to be willing to come in under, right? Like they want the most timely read of inflation as possible. And so they're going to use things that are more sensitive and perhaps more front loaded. And so as a result, you know, you're probably going to just get, you know, readings that look maybe like a basis point, 5 basis points too high or something like that. But I don't think there's any situation where people are like, you know, overestimating kind of the impact. I think the estimation is actually quite good on a month-on-month basis. The thing that's a lot more interesting, so the energy pass-through component is very well modeled and very well understood, right? So like you're not going to be able to beat the street on that at all, right? You're generally not going to be able to beat the street on most things, but on that component, you're not going to be able to beat the street at all. And then the part that's more interesting is that what you have to recognize is that like oil is basically a central input to every single good and then passes through the supply chain up to every single service. The oil is the center of the modern economy, whether we like it or not, given our politics, but like that is the state of the world. And so what happens is when you have these types of oil shocks, coupled with also what we're having, we have a lot of agricultural product and agricultural related product that actually pass through the strait. When you have food and energy shocks both at the same time, they slowly work their way through the supply chain and basically filter to every single other good and service. And so, you know, the transition is first you have the food and energy shock, that food and energy shock turns into a good shock, that good shock turns into a services shock. That's how it slowly kind of goes through. And so Bob's smiling because I know he's done the same work. But, you know, that's how the sequence of events kind of flows. And the uncertainty is in the multiples, like how much of the pass through you get at each stage, right? Like we're not sure. We know directionally that the food and energy shock turns into a good shock. And then we know the good shock turns into a service shock. But how much passes through is a difficult thing to estimate. But so, you know, when you're thinking through the inflation picture, what you have to recognize is that we have the first order impacts completely captured well. But now it's the second and third order that we have to do hard work to kind of figure out. And that's what's really going to start to impact the Fed and the markets subsequently from there as well.
I don't know if you have anything to add, Bob, on what Ahan just said.
Well, I think the core of it is like households don't care whether prices are above or below expectations. Doesn't matter to them. You can have some at the gas pump. They will not know expectations, but they will know the price. And that's the only thing that matters. In these sorts of environments, right, is basically like, you know, because if prices are up a lot, then what's going to happen is that's going to kick off that process, which was just described. But if otherwise, you know, and if prices aren't up a lot, then it doesn't kick off that process. And that's the basic story. It's just like at some level, not that complicated. And so I think you get cute about the exact numbers, and it doesn't, you know, it's important to recognize that the measurement isn't even necessarily, there's no like truth about the measurement itself. I don't mean that there's any misrepresentation or lying or anything like that. It's just like, you know, like it's just kind of a sampling, and it's just an effort to get a sense of it. And ultimately the big picture is prices are up a lot, and that's going to have second and third order consequences down the line, which again are going to be very slow. Today's gas price hikes will show up in tomorrow's, you know, fuel surcharges, which will show up in the next day's, you know, modestly higher haircut cost. And it takes a long time. And so this is the thing that you, I mean, I think you're hearing from both of us, like sometimes macro is like really boring because it takes a long time for this stuff to play out. If you could be disciplined in that process, then you can, you know, you can benefit from that. But you have to be very disciplined and recognize that it takes, you know, a long time to play out.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, this kind of relates back to my other question, or just the thing, how to properly think through this and then also take action. Because when we got the oil shock, you know, some people were also quickly to point out, well, this has a disinflationary effect, you know, because way down the road, obviously, as you just also neatly described, you know, everything is going to get more expensive. And then at some point, the consumer will roll over because he will feel the higher prices and maybe cut down on consumption. And I feel like there is inflation first, to some extent, and then, you know, the disinflation effects coming afterwards. But again, where this tipping point might be at, you know, and then how you can position as an investor, you know, to figure out, okay, I don't want to be too early, I don't want to be too late, you know. So that's also something I guess rookies ask themselves. Is that even worth asking themselves, you know, or is that a wrong question altogether to think about it, to figure out this kind of tipping point, you know, where one could translate into the other? I don't know, Ahan, maybe you have.
Yeah. You know, I, you know, when this whole thing kind of started, like one of the most, you know, I feel like a pervasive discussion and a client question, like I got fairly often was like, when do we do the bond trade, right? Like, when do we do the big bond trade, the demand destruction trade or whatever? And I think that like the super important thing to recognize is that like, we're still basically, you know, in that four-step sequence, we're between one and two, which is the cross-asset impact and then the CPI impact. We're in between those two stages. And during those two stages, like, you know, doing bonds outright during those two stages is a very, very painful trade. Because, you know, every unit of oil price rise is basically an implied rise in break evens, which is a pressure on bonds, right? And so, you know, that there is a point where you do the trade after the trade, as it's so often called. Mm. But I think that you have to recognize that, like we're describing, this process takes time. And first we have to see sustained inflation. And that sustained inflation has to turn into demand destruction. And that demand destruction has to look juicy enough that the Fed has to respond. And that's when, you know, you're going to get that big bond trade that a lot of people are excited about. Before then, I think that you're potentially trying to do the trade of trying to catch a falling knife. And I think that is, you know, doing bonds outright is a very difficult trade to do just now. You know, I'm somewhat partial to like the expression that Bob has, because you are long bonds in the expression. So when you're short stocks and long bonds, but that's a different expression where you're basically neutralizing your inflation expectations, and you're just making a pure bet on the growth going down. And so that looks a lot cleaner than trying to do bonds outright.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting question as well. I want to throw in this theory, you know, that maybe relates to this, because we mentioned capital flows in the beginning, you know, that you're good friends with him as well. And I was just reading something he put out, and that was kind of interesting, because he was sort of saying, and I only paraphrase here, he could probably sum it up himself way better. We have this possibility now for inflation, heated inflation, but maybe inflation which still kind of stays contained, you know. Then you have an inflationary impulse that persists but doesn't get out of hand.
And then the Fed, maybe the market is already telling the Fed and expecting them to pause, which could then be the case that they hold rates steady, which he argues could bring actual liquidity back into the system, you know, through lower real rates, because inflation kind of elevated. And that could create this melt-up scenario in the next few weeks to months, at least as I understand it. I don't know. Have you guys thought this through as well? Is that a possibility, or like, what do you think of this kind of scenario playing out as well?
When you think about questions like that, like, do you think about real financing costs and this like spot real financing costs versus nominal financing costs? The question becomes who will do what differently as a function of that behavior. And so as a simple example, let's say, you know, the Fed's short-term interest rate or SOFR or whatever is basically flat and inflation is higher versus less high. You know, basically, you know, if inflation is 2 versus inflation is 3 or 4, we'll probably get to 4 in that sort of order of magnitude based on current prices, the change. But who is actually going, who's like, you know what, inflation's 4, I'm going to lever up. It's like, nobody. Like it's bad thinking. What it is it's theoretical thinking. That's the problem. Like, take it from a person who has traded these markets for decades. No person is saying, oh, well, you know, short-term interest rates are flat, but inflation CPI numbers went from 2 to 4. Therefore, I'm going to lever up. Like, no, like maybe people might lever up because they think that there's going to be a lot of asset price appreciation. But as we've seen and as we've talked about in terms of the second and third order consequences, actually would make you more cautious, right? Because higher price growth means that you have an erosion of demand, right? As a result, because you have reduced spending power, which reduces real demand. And so if anything, it would put you in the opposite direction because you don't actually get paid the inflation. The only way you get paid the inflation, meaning essentially the real rate goes down, is if the prices of the assets go up. The effect is actually the exact opposite.
I don't know if you have something to add on, but because maybe just quickly. Yeah, Chico, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, it boils down to there are different kinds of inflation, right? Like you have a supply shock induced inflation, which is what we're experiencing right now. And there's a demand pull kind of inflation that, you know, you more typically. So I would understand the case that we have an extremely hard economy where we're firing on all cylinders and nominal activity is extremely strong. That's inflationary and that's pulling up output. I don't see that as really being the case today, right? And I don't see, you know, just like Bob's describing, like I don't see the reason that this inflation shock would result in businesses levering up majorly, because you just don't have the demand conditions in place, like the nominal demand conditions in place. And so, you know, without that kind of really strong or accelerating nominal growth backdrop to fuel, you know, more leverage, I kind of agree that, you know, this is not that type of situation.
Yeah, it's very, very good to think through it like this, because I haven't done so far, because as it sounds to me, it is quite theoretical, this concept of real interest rates. It always has, you know, but then I was just wondering, maybe the point is more about it kind of, you know, people are forced then, as you said yourself, Bob, they're looking for higher asset prices. And because these real interest rates are getting lower to the point where they might tip negative at some point, it's just that people feel forced to go out the risk curve. And that's why they invest into riskier stuff. And you could see sort of this melt up in the markets proliferate. But yeah, I mean, you have to think about it in real life scenarios for sure. The overall economy, you know, some people have also been saying, you know, ever since the oil shock, okay, see everything I told you, it's been doing worse before, or it's been doing bad before. And now this is just late stage behavior, you know, oil going up. We've seen that in the past. How have you guys been changing your view on the economy? Is it sort of reinforcing what you thought before has kind of been going on, or has it changed kind of like your view? I guess it must have, because it is a significant exogenous shock. But yeah, what is the state of the overall economy, if we want to say so?
From my perspective, coming into it, we had been seeing a gradual softening of economic conditions in the U.S. economy. And again, like everyone gets super focused on recession and some sort of acute move. And honestly, it's been like watching paint dry. Like we've slowly moved from household income growth, you know, that's 5 to 6% to the latest data prior to the war, running at about a little over 3% nominal income growth for households coming into it. And, you know, that transpired over a couple of years. That slowing transpired over a couple of years. And that is, you know, 3% or a little over 3% nominal income growth in an environment of roughly 3% inflation means that, you know, real spending power is not particularly strong. Now, for a while, households have been able to maintain their spending power because they've de-saved, meaning they've, you know, essentially their savings rate has fallen, which has allowed them to keep spending growth above income growth. But even that had faded to some extent over the course of the last 24 months. And so coming into this, and this is where, you know, the data kind of sets the baseline. The data doesn't tell you anything about the impact of the oil shock, but it sort of sets the baseline. We were seeing real household spending growth running at about, I think it was 1.25% for the average of the 6 months leading into, you know, leading to the end of February. But that's not a disaster. It's not a boom. It's not a total bust. It's kind of a little soft, right? That's kind of what it is. And now, and that's important because now what we're seeing is essentially we'll see a 1% to 2%, give or take, probably on the upper end of that range, impact on price growth. Prices rising, which means a reduction in household real spending capacity. And, you know, as asset prices have kind of leveled out here, probably less desire to draw down savings in order to maintain spending. And that is like not a great outlook. It's not we're in a recession, you know, that we're seeing massive negative growth or anything like that. It's just like kind of crappy. That's kind of what the outlook looks like. We went from so-so to kind of crappy. That's been the transition as a result of the oil shock.
Yeah, I think my characterization. Sorry, did I cut you off, Bob?
No, please.
Yeah. I think my characterization is along the same lines. I think that maybe, you know, our reads of, you know, consumer spending, or, you know, we do work on basically looking at kind of the investment components in GDP a lot. Maybe they were a little bit, you know, rosier than the way Bob saw the picture coming into this event. But this event has been a very, very big change to the outlook for me. The two reasons. So basically, I think that when you think through the dynamic Bob is describing, where you have kind of income growth, which has been definitely slowing, right? Like you can see it in just the fact that like the labor market has been cooling and, you know, wage rates are fairly constant. And so you had an income growth, which is kind of slowing. But at the same time, consumers are taking that income growth and they are spending more than their income growth, right? So that creates a plus on the GDP side. And what it also does is that this saving is a direct fuel for corporate profits. And that fuel for corporate profits is really what kind of staves off a big firing cycle, you know? So for a recession to happen, you need to have a big firing cycle. And that big firing cycle usually happens when, you know, corporate profits are under pressure and financial conditions are under pressure. And those financial conditions are really a proxy of, like, you know, the way corporations kind of feel about their future prospects, right? So that, like, when you get kind of that medley of things, that's when you start to have a big kind of firing cycle. And so when you look at that, the picture of what's been fueling this expansion, it's really just been that consumer dynamic, right? It's been a really strong consumer. That excess consumption relative to income has been fueling the profits, and the profits are really good, so we can do more CapEx, and you kind of have this really nice kind of virtuous cycle. The thing that I think this whole dynamic really does is it changes the consumer balance, right? So when you have this really, really, you know, big shock to inflation, now consumers have to make a choice, right? Like they have to redistribute their consumption and probably have to bring back their real consumption. And that is a pressure on the output, so that, which is effectively, you know, the revenue level. And then that's also a pressure on the corporate profits, right? And that exposes you to, you know, an increase. So like, it's not like, oh, we're diving into recession immediately. It's just that with this kind of big cost shock, you have the increased probabilities of recession, you know, for recession or recessionary type environment.
Given that both of you mentioned this savings rate, you know, because I've seen it floating around a lot on X as well. What actually does it entail? Is it just a cash and like bank deposits that are being drawn down by people, or like what is it? Is it actual cash, or what are they just saving in that sense? Would you know, Ahan?
Oh yeah, sure. basically, look, when it comes to the savings rate, so first off, like, the savings rate is not like my preferred metric, because, like, it's, you know, there's no timing the savings rate. Like, there's no specific, like, at 2.0, you hit the inflection point. But when it comes to dissaving, right, like, basically, consumers receive a variety of income sources. So they receive their wages, but they also receive rental income. They receive proprietor's income. They also receive income from the government, all those different sources of income. So what happens when the savings rate is going down is typically you're pulling from somewhere on your balance sheet, right? So which place on the balance sheet are you pulling from? You can be pulling from your cash balances, or you could be selling assets, right? So it's usually a mix of, you know, reducing your cash balance and also, you know, perhaps selling down some of your assets, which doesn't actually affect the accounting effect of your cash balance. And so, you know, people are basically drawing from their balance sheets to fuel their spending is the direct answer to your question. With regards to the saving rate specifically, I'm not a big fan, because the savings rate doesn't really tell you when things are going to change. What we prefer to do typically is to track what we would call, like, this is a little tedious to explain, but, like, effectively the private side, like the household flow to profits, right? And what that is you can kind of imagine it in a stylized kind of simple way, is just the difference between consumption and wages, right? And when that number begins to really compress a lot, that's a much better indicator of where you are in the cycle, whether you're approaching the end of the cycle or beginning of the cycle, than just looking at the level of the savings rate.
Do you see the same, Bob? Because I mean, it makes total sense to me that it's not, there's not this break or make level with the savings rate. You know, at this point, okay, you know, we're back to 1.9, and in 2007, you know, we were at 1.9, and now everything has to go into recession. But I mean, conceptually thinking about this, households can only dissave this much, you know, or like, how do you think about this? Similar to Ahan as well?
Yeah. I when you think savings rate is a concept, meaning, yeah. And I think as described actually quite well, is the real concept is how much are you earning from all your various sources versus how much you're spending. And I think one of the challenges is, let me just think about it. Like, we're talking about, for instance, if we look over the past 24 months, households have spent on average, their spending growth has been about 2% higher than their wage growth, their income growth, to make it simple, right? So that's 4% essentially over, accumulated 4% over a 2-year time frame. Now you look at that and you say to yourself, is that a lot or a little? The answer is, like, it's not actually that much. Like, total household savings is like 800% of GDP, or 800% as a percent of their income. So, like, drawing down 4% doesn't really matter, right? So actually what matters more, there's no, like, levels that influence this. Levels are a terrible way of thinking about this problem for that exact reason, which is they could draw down faster, they could draw down slower. They have all the cash flow in the world. It's still, to be clear, positive, right? In the sense of, like, there's still households in aggregate, and most households in specific are still spending less than they're earning, which means, of course, they are, you know, they can just do that less, right? They can just, spend more out of the income that they have from a cash flow perspective. And so it's much better off to start to think about, what are the motivations for why you would want to spend more than you're earning? You know, why you pick up your spending growth relative to your earnings, right? Or why you would want to pull back? And those sort of adjustments are actually much more meaningful than any particular level in any particular moment.
Yes, thank you for laying out these concepts. That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, you know, from what I'm hearing when I listen to you guys, it feels like the consumer has been hurting already, and it will hurt, continuously hurt, you know, and might potentially even more because of the inflation shock that might be coming our way, you know? And so at the same time, you know, I feel like some people are still pointing, or it's been some sort of common knowledge, you know, that the consumer sentiment is down and consumers are not doing well, this K-shaped economy kind of talk that everyone has been referencing. But then some point to the 6% deficit, you know, which we're still somewhat at peak employment, you know, during this major corporate investment cycle that we have by larger companies. And that's why the economy seems to be still doing well,
if the consumer might not be doing that well, you know. But even there, if I look closely, I feel like at the rate of change, from what I can gather, things are also kind of slowing down, you know, this investment cycle and then fiscal. I just checked FRET numbers recently. I think it's down 11 or 12% year over year. So this all points to me that things are slowing down. And Bob, you said it as well. I think you had this base case already. So yeah, again, how do I think about this going forward? Where is the tipping point? It's maybe a dumb question, but yeah. I hope you guys understand what I mean. How do you think about these incremental steps again, you know, with all these things coming together and not looking very rosy at least? Yeah.
I mean, when it comes to the fiscal spend, I don't know if Bob has a different view, but like I just haven't been in the camp that like the X, you know, probably the 2 years following COVID, I just haven't believed that the fiscal presence has actually been as much as is made out in the media. So, you know, there's a balance sheet presence of the Treasury and the Treasury being very big and all of that type of stuff and all the mechanics surrounding the Treasury and the Fed and all that stuff. And that's really important. But that is totally different from like the economic effect of deficit spending into the economy to GDP, which, you know, basically filters to revenues of companies. And I, you know, by all reads that we look, like we're talking about, you know, if GDP is running at 2%, like government spending, right, in GDP is about 0.2% off that number. And so, you know, for me, the fiscal argument has never been something that's, you know, very, very, like a very compelling one. And, you know, when you look at it more recently, especially after the recent government shutdown and things like that, like the fiscal kind of impulse to GDP has been negative. And so, you know, overall, my kind of view on fiscal is that it's just not the thing to focus on. But I would be curious about Bob's view on the same.
Yeah, I mostly share that thought. I think, you know, these are all things that happen on the margin. And so like one of the questions I think coming into the year, we sort of in 25 got a bit of a fiscal tightening effectively. It's not a huge deal, but, you know, marginal fiscal tightening because the tariff revenue was more significant than was, you know, some expansionary elements that were introduced into the economy. And the thought is sort of as we transition to this year, meaning 2026, that tariffs, we actually have seen tariffs come down from sort of peaking at $35 billion a month to $25 billion a month, and combined with some fiscal loosening from the Big Beautiful Bill would be, you know, a modestly positive, modestly expansionary dynamic. I think in all those cases, the actual effect on the real economy is less meaningful than the numbers themselves might suggest, given that, you know, businesses actually absorb, you know, have absorbed, U.S. businesses have absorbed a fair amount of the tariff part of it. So, you know, it's not that big a deal in terms of the magnitude of the changes. And there's also some questions about whether the tariffs will come back, and the president's making a number of efforts to bring the tariffs back, or at least stabilize them at these levels. And then you talk about the Big Beautiful Bill, where most of the benefit has either been eroded almost immediately related to the oil prices going up, meaning, yep, people are getting more refunds and they're just paying that at the gas pump. And the fact that most of the benefit is actually in sort of the 250,000 to a million cohort of income earners, which, like, you know, the flow through effect of that is not that high. You know, if you pay slightly lower, if you have to make a tax payment at the end of the year and you pay slightly lower, mostly that doesn't affect your future income. And so, you know, they're not all of these things. I kind of have the same like emotional attitude towards it, which is like, there's a lot of conversation about it. It doesn't really matter that much. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe on the margin, it's a little beneficial to the economy, but it wouldn't be a game changer. Other things like, you know, the amount of CapEx going on related to AI and things like that, I think are way bigger deals in terms of what may be affecting both the, you know, positives in terms of the economy and profit.
With fiscal out of the way and CapEx, you know, that you just mentioned, I want to turn to the energy story real quick, you know, because I know, Ahan, you've been writing about this as well. And my question would be, you know, is it now an oil thesis that we have with the supply shock, as well as the CapEx thesis, you know, AI power thesis, energy producer needed for that AI coming together? And then you have like two of these big forces. And so
energy is like the must-do trade for now that you have to be in, or how do you think about this?
Do you mean the energy sector stocks or the
Mostly.
Energy sector stocks. Like I know I post a lot about like you have to do the energy trade or whatever, right? And I think you know, this is like kind of code switching between different silos of the macro world. But when I say the energy trade, I mean the oil complex, right? Like that's what I mean. Like you need to have a dedicated energy stave in the oil complex, not so much the energy equities. Because and there's like a specific reason for that, right? Like so when you look at what energy equity is, so like if you're talking about like the energy index in the S&P 500, what that is it's a mix of energy and backdated energy futures, right? Like that then, and so, you know, when you, and so what that actually boils down to is three separate trades. You're betting on the equity beta, you're betting on spot oil, and then you're betting on the term structure, right? And from my perspective and like a systematic macro perspective, we would rather separate those bets and take them individually rather than, you know, mix them all into one thing, because you can get a much more targeted and cleaner expression targeting those individual components. And so from where we sit, like, I think it's clear to us that, you know, I think by almost every measure out there that we are, you know, in a supply shock, right? We are in a supply shock. And the thing is that unlike a lot of, you know, financial assets where things can get immediately priced in and, you know, can reflect future outcomes, like, you know, almost entirely, oil and the oil complex have very, very low demand. So even if, you know, Brent is at $160 a barrel, unfortunately, we still have to buy the oil. And so, you know, you have this consistent kind of pressure upwards on oil, even though there's already existing pressure. And so, you know, the way we look at the energy is that, like, we like energy broadly across the curve. I think that if you are going to participate across the curve, the front end of the curve needs to be very, very responsive to things that are happening with both policy and price dynamics and, you know, kind of the timely reads of activity in the trade. And then on the back end, you're getting very, very nice kind of carry roll properties because of the tremendous amounts of backwardation in the curve. And so, you know, for different reasons, we like different parts of the curve, but I think that like, energy is probably the most, like, if you're actively investing, right? Like, unless, you know, you're allocating to someone else, which I highly recommend in certain cases. I think that, you know, if you're actively investing, I think energy as an addition to your portfolio is probably one of the most additive things that you can be doing right now.
Anything you have to add, Bob, on the energy side of things? Are you guys looking at this as well?
Well, I think the extreme backwardation creates like very interesting dynamics. Like, let's say just a very specific thing is let's say you want to trade December 26 WTI at $77. You know, could it be below $77 in December? Yeah, sure. It could go, I don't know, 60 is what it started the year at. You know, could it go much below that? Like, for a variety of reasons, the floor is in that order of magnitude because of, you know, you start to get shut-ins, or maybe not literal shut-ins, but slowing of production if you get below 60 in North America. And if oil prices are meaningfully above $77, your stocks and bonds are going to get wrecked. And just like everyone holds stocks and bonds, and a lot of them, and they basically hold no exposure in the event that we have upside environments and energy, right? And so I think that's an interesting, you know, that's an interesting use case where I'm just picking that as a particular concrete way to think about it, which is like, okay, does it feel like you have enough protection for your stocks and bonds when the cost is to buy, you know, December 26 oil at $77? It's, you know, I think most people are vastly underexposed given that circumstance, because the worst case scenario, if you buy that oil and it, you know, it ends up at $60, and like, as a long only, you know, as a predominantly long asset holder, if oil goes back to $60, like, you will be in the money on your portfolio as a whole, right? And, you know, assuming you size it in a reasonable way. And so I think people aren't thinking about those scenario analysis and those cross asset valuations and the curve and things like that. You know, I think that you have to in order to really appreciate the opportunities that exist in that market.
I think that the comment that you just made, you know, relates really well to this, one of the last questions I wanted to send your way, you know, and you had this very elegant quote on X that I want to reference here. Spikes in oil prices have almost always been driven by rising conflict. Today is no different. The trouble is that a standard 60-40 portfolio most folks hold is effectively an all-in bet in peace and disinflation. I found this very intriguing. Can you elaborate on this? And then also maybe what would be the advice then? You know, like for me personally, I do work in a bank, investment bank, private bank, Swiss bank. You know, for us, this is still sort of the go-to portfolio. You know, you have any advice for these people as well? How you can kind of steer around the steering wheel, you know, or yank it around?
I think it's important to recognize that anyone who's been in markets as a professional investor has their like life experience has been somewhat extraordinary when it comes to the level of the low level of conflict that exists in the world. Like if you go back and look at deaths and conflicts over the last 2000 years, what you'd see is essentially the last, you know, 40 years is the lowest that we've ever seen in, you know, modern recorded human history. Now, that's a good thing. I'm not saying that you know, I have some desire for things to become, you know, to have greater conflict, but it's also worth recognizing that that basically bottomed in, you know, in 2010, give or take, and we've had a series of escalating conflicts emerging from there, and that basically no one, you know, a 60-40 portfolio has been entirely designed around the idea that we're not going to have conflict. It was part of, you know, the post-World War II order and hegemony by the U.S. And that those are the reasons why it's been so effective at basically creating, you know, good returns for investors. And so I just wouldn't assume that that's going to exist in the future. Now, does that mean that you should only hold, you know, gold and oil and buy a property in upstate New York with a spring and get a lot of guns and be prepared for the end of humanity? Like, no, you should like prudently consider the possibility we might have more conflict and with it more inflation and more commodity price appreciation. But for some reason, every time I bring up the idea, like maybe you should hold 10% of your portfolio in gold and commodities, like people think I'm that guy with the cabin. just like a very normal thing, like consider the possibility we have more conflict ahead. And yet, if you ask people, when I say zero people hold commodities, like diversified commodities, I mean, like I went to a CFA event, there were 400 people in the audience. They said, how many of you hold commodities in your portfolio? The answer was zero, like literally zero, right? So that's how far away most portfolios are from being able to capture these sorts of events.
Yeah, I mean, I have a similar experience as well, you know, working at the bank. I mean, we're just coming around now again to the idea of commodities maybe being one part, but then I mean it's maybe 2 or 3 or 5%, you know, it's not more. I don't know, Ahan, you have similar views on that? And
yeah
because I always ask myself the question, yeah, how do you diversify, you know, away? I mean, it's easily said that the 60-40 portfolio is not maybe the thing to do right now anymore, but then where do you go? You know, you could just have Bitcoin and gold, or like what other options are there? Like,
yeah, so I think there are maybe 2 or 3 levels to this. So there's, I think that without a doubt, you need to, every investor, you know, like it's not just today, right? Over time, I think Bob has been, you know, an advocate, you know, as long, forever of having, you know, of having commodities in the portfolio. And we have too. And, you know, recent experiences taught people not to do that, right? Like not to have commodities. All you need to do is have equities, you know, forget even the fixed income now. Now you just have only equities and it's great. But, you know, you every now and again, you have these types of environments come around where equities and bonds just aren't designed to perform well. And then, you know, people realize that, hey, like maybe I need to have commodities and usually it's too late. So I'm a proponent of having commodities in your asset allocation constantly, right? Now, I think that commodities require more management because, you know, the futures are usually expressed through futures contracts. So you need a little bit more of a professional hand, but today you do have a lot more of these ETFs available that where you can, you know, have a commodity allocation. But the hard thing, I think, is that commodities are they're not like equities and fixed income in that they don't have constant positive drift. They don't just keep going up over time steadily, you know, kind of adding to your portfolio balance. And so when you look at them, you know, you might have 5 or 10 years where you're like, oh, this is a complete waste of time. But it's during periods like this where commodities make up for that and then some. And so I think one thing that, you know, I could perhaps share with the audience that I think is really useful is that the intuition around commodities is actually the opposite of, you know, what equity and bond investors have. So equity and bond investors are what I call counter-cyclical investors. You're looking for value, right? Because equities earn an earnings yield, bonds give you a bond yield. And so you want to typically buy those when prices have come down a lot and those yields are very high. Commodities have kind of a weird relationship. So commodities have yield, but that yield kind of is in the form of the term structure, yes, right? That term structure becomes very, very rich during periods of stress, like today. So when you have a supply shock, you get intense amounts of backwardation. That happens to be at the exact time that commodities are rallying viciously. And so, you know, many investors kind of look at commodities and say, oh man, they've gone up, you know, 50%, 100%. Oh, there's no point owning them. And they're applying that equity market kind of lens to commodities, where it's actually the exact opposite in commodities. The times of shortage and the times of intense backwardation are the exact times that commodities are the most useful and the most additive to your portfolio. So, you know, you have to kind of do that mental gearing of, hey, like, the equilibrium for commodities is kind of dynamic, and I need to be able to understand that, hey, it's okay to buy into strength. So that's one thing. So that's the first layer. The second layer is that the strategies that do that really well are trend following strategies, right? Like strategies that have some awareness of trend. And, you know, so in these types of environments, adding commodity trend or an advisor that has an understanding of commodity trend and these relationships that I'm describing is really, really additive. And then, of course, there are all kinds of different products out there that basically give you access to diversified fund allocations, right? And I think that those strategies as well are poised to perform well in these types of environments because of the dynamics I'm describing. You have this divergence in the properties of the different asset classes that creates mechanical diversification, and that suits any type of diversified asset manager really well. So I think those are the different kind of levers you can pull to kind of go from, okay, I'm a 60-40 investor to I want something more diversified and comprehensive.
Great, just great. Thank you, guys. We're already way past the 1 hour mark, but I want to ask this last question once again. You know, let me reformulate because I did ask it before, but I feel like I messed up. But, you know, how do I make sure I translate macro the right way into what I trade? You have any thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, my primary thought, which is probably a disappointment to anyone listening to this, is like, you should actually not trade tactically macro themes. Like, it is very hard. You know, your win rate on any one trade is 55-45. All too often, what's happening is people are making like huge portfolio bets. Like, I remember, you know, I don't know, people were making huge portfolio bets that like bonds were dead with interest rates at 5%, which was the best time to be buying bonds, right? Even today, I talk to financial advisors in the United States who hold zero bonds, right? And it's like, wow, that is a huge bet in your portfolio. Like, you might be right and you might be wrong. And if you're right, you're probably lucky rather than good. And that is just way too much risk to be taking. I think probably the best thing you can be doing is start to think about, instead of thinking about macro and the individual bets, think about macro trading as a return stream in the same way you might think about managed futures as a return stream. They're kind of related to each other, although they're not exactly the same. And start to ask yourself, okay, is this an environment where professional macro traders should, you know, be advantaged, right? Are there big macro themes that are driving markets? Or is this an environment where a lot of microeconomic, you know, individual company stuff is the big themes that are driving things? I think what we've seen is over the course of the last, you know, certainly post-COVID, macro dynamics have been huge in terms of driving market moves and macro and trend.
have been able to deliver very compelling returns to portfolios and returns that are diversifying to portfolios. And so that's where I think, you know, you're best off sort of in some ways, like leave it to the professionals and find the most efficient way to get access to that and the cheapest way to get access to that to the professionals. But really, you should be leaving it to the professional.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
Or, good or advice. You should just be following Prometheus's regular portfolio.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I was just going to say this. Maybe I can hand over the last word to you, Ahan. Yeah. Then like,
well, I think it's a toss up. If you want to trade yourself, you can buy some Prometheus stuff. If you want to leave it to the professionals, Bob's got a whole lot of stuff for you. I definitely think you should be checking all of that out. But I think that Bob just said it right. Like, what you want to think about is either you have to be able to construct a diversified set of bets yourself, you know, professional experience. You know, if you've done that, great. You know what you're doing. Partner with someone that, you know, knows what they're doing, or, you know, you just leave it to the professionals. So I think that was perfectly said, and I'll leave it at that.
Yes, guys. Thanks a lot for doing this. Thanks also for bearing with me and sometimes with my oversimplified and maybe somewhat flippant questions. But I learned a lot. Thanks a lot. And I hope you guys are doing well, and maybe we'll do it in the future again. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, guys. Enjoy. Bye.
Right. Bye.